ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 10th of December. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Australia's social media ban for under 16-year-olds has started, making it a world-first push to protect children from phone addiction and online harms. From now, a group of 10 social media platforms will face a $50 million fine if they don't take reasonable steps to stop children and teenagers aged under 16 from holding a social media account. But as Isabel Massali reports, kids are already getting around the ban.
Along with end-of-year class parties, school children have this special pre-recorded message from Anthony Albanese this week.
It's the Prime Minister here, and I wanted to speak to you directly about something very important. From December 10, if you're under 16, you're no longer allowed to have a social media account.
But that's not been the case for Brisbane teenager Andoni Garrett.
Stay out of my feed, Albanese.
13-year-old Andoni Garrett says he's already got around the bans on Snapchat and Instagram, posing as a 34-year-old.
It was actually really easy and it worked. Just let me through.
His dad, Matt Garrett, says screen time has been the top source of conflict since Andoni was required to get a tablet for school 5 years ago.
We were really looking forward to having more quality family time. So the fact that it just has fallen over at such a basic level is very disappointing.
The government admits it won't be perfect, but the policy is worth trying anyway. Australia's social media ban marks the first time a nation has attempted to take on the big tech giants to protect children.
Growing up with algorithms, endless speeds, and the pressure that can come with that. That's why we've taken this step to support you.
And it's being watched across the world. RMIT Professor of Information Sciences, Lisa Givens, says other nations want to see if they should change their approach and if they can make a ban more robust.
How do we define success? Certainly if it's looking to have 90 to 100% of kids off the platforms, we're probably not going to see that. And that's really where we need additional legislation to deal with potential harm that all these kids are still going to continue to face.
If you'd asked Professor Given a year ago if the ban would actually happen, she would have said no. But like it or not, it's here. And she says any legal challenges on behalf of tech giants or users may take months or years.
I think the critical thing that we're going to see today is really how this works in practice. I think we've already seen early stories about some kids who have been doing age assurance, for example, and getting through the checks even though they're under 16. I think we'll likely hear some reports of older people who may also be caught up in the ban even though they're technically over 16.
And if authorities tighten age verification processes, teenager Andoni Garrett has this message.
If Albanese tries anything more, then we'll always find a way around it. We're going to win the war somehow.
Teenager Andoni Garrett, ending that report by Isabel Massali and Ange Lavoie-Pierre. For mum Emma Mason, the social media ban is a huge relief. She's campaigned for it. And the reason why might be distressing. Emma's name might be familiar to you. She delivered a powerful speech at the United Nations General Assembly in September about her daughter, Tilly, who died by suicide in 2022 after relentless online bullying. Nicole Johnston reports.
Hi, my name's Emma Mason, and I'm the mother of Tilly Rosewarne.
Ms. Mason posted this video on social media to tell the world what happened to her daughter, and for Australian families to get ready for the social media ban.
Tilly was 15 and she died on the 16th of February 2022 by suicide. She was your average Australian child who intersected with social media, and unfortunately she was bullied in person, and then as time went on and technology developed and social media developed, she ended up being bullied on social media, being told when there was an argument that she should go kill herself, that she wasn't worth it. And we need to, as a society, step away from this destruction that has been wreaked on our children. And hopefully we've got some time to heal in this regard.
Ms. Mason is a lawyer and has been one of the leaders of the campaign to ban social media for children aged under 16 years. In October, she spoke at a meeting on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. It was raw and confronting.
My brave little girl, determined to look pretty, put on her makeup one last time. She'd planned this moment out in detail. She'd done her research. She'd done it online and made sure everything would work this time.
Australia's social media ban is being watched around the world. Denmark says it's eyeing it as a potential model. The president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has called it bold. And the European Parliament has passed a non-binding resolution to restrict children's social media use.
The member countries voted overall to bring this legislation in their member countries. We have countries all over the world who have come to Australia to find out what Australia is doing. And in the end, we will have most countries of the world standing up against the social media companies, and they will have to change.
How will this legislation actually work?
The legislation flips the responsibility to the social media companies. They have now penalties in Australia of up to $49.5 million for every breach.
As a parent, do you think part of the problem was parents didn't feel empowered enough to use their authority to keep their children off social media?
We're fighting an algorithm. We are fighting large social media companies, and in every lounge room this battle goes on as the addiction takes hold for children. And, you know, we are fighting and fighting, and our households have become battlefields.
That's Emma Mason, who's campaigned for the social media ban, ending that report by Nicole Johnston. And if this story has raised concerns for you or anyone you know, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Annika Wells is the Federal Communications and Sports Minister in charge of overseeing the social media ban. Normally, she'd be front and centre of a policy like this, but she's been facing daily questions for a week now about the use of family travel entitlements, enabling reunions at big sporting events. Ms. Wells has now asked for an audit of her travel claims. Isabella Tolhurst is at Parliament House in Canberra. Isabella, with the Minister now asking for an audit, will this take the heat out of the issue?
Well, it's what the opposition has been calling for, and they've obviously been one of the parties really driving this conversation along. It might take a bit of the sting out of the conversation around Annika Wells. We've already seen this conversation begin to shift to other politicians and their spending. What an investigation will do, I suppose, is put to bed any doubt, if it turns out that her spending is all within the rules. It'll put to bed any doubt about that. What it won't do is ease any of the questions surrounding her judgment. This issue has really been a question of whether she's made the right decisions during a cost of living crisis, using business or first class tickets to New York, flying her husband to the Grand Prix, leaving drivers waiting for hours at a time. It's a matter of judgment on whether she's out of touch with community expectations. So an investigation may not do what it needs to do to address that. She has been stopped at Sydney Airport yesterday by the Australian. Here's what she had to say about it to them.
I'm the Australian Minister for Sport. My job is to attend Australian sporting events, be it community or major. I think the counterfactual is if I didn't, I'd also be subject to scrutiny and criticism. I really do my best to discharge my duties to everybody who needs me. That includes all of my stakeholders, all the people who elect me, and my family.
That's the Federal Communications and Sports Minister, Annika Wells. Isabella, what about other politicians? Is there scrutiny of their travel expenses as well?
Absolutely. We here at Parliament House have been raking through the data, looking for any other examples, because we were aware that Annika Wells was most likely not the only politician to be using the family reunion entitlements. There's been $1.1 million spent in the past financial year by politicians flying their family around Australia. $700,000 of that was travel to and from Canberra, so visiting them while they're here during sitting weeks, presumably. $400,000 on flights between other destinations in Australia, and $60,000 on Comcars. Trade Minister Don Farrell spent the most, racking up a bill of almost $50,000. Independent West Australian Senator Fadiman Payman was in second, and former opposition leader Peter Dutton came in third. Now, of the top 20 spenders, eight of them are from WA, and the highest average spend is by politicians from the Northern Territory. So a lot of that can be explained by the fact that there's such a long distance. But other politicians have also been questioned about their judgment as well. Shadow Communications Minister Melissa McIntosh, so Annika Wells's counterpart, spent $2,000 for herself and her son to travel to the Gold Coast so he could take part in a judo competition. So her spending has been brought into question as well. This is leaking out of Annika Wells's office and into everyone else's.
Isabella Tolhurst in Canberra, and the Federal Shadow Communications Minister Melissa McIntosh has defended her Gold Coast trip, telling Sky News she didn't know about the judo competition before planning her work trip. Australia must lean more heavily on solar farms, big batteries and households installing clean energy if it wants to hit its green energy goals by the end of the decade. That's the view of the Australian Energy Market Operator, which has watered down its plans for wind farms and transmission lines as community unrest and rising costs bite. Energy reporter Daniel Mercer has the story.
In many ways, 2025 has been a big year for Chris O'Keefe's members. He's the national spokesman for the Clean Energy Council, which represents renewable energy developers across the country. And so far this year, they've started construction on more than 5 gigawatts of new capacity, the equivalent of 5 coal-fired power stations.
The industry is getting on with it, without question, and big international investors are still coming to Australia in their droves with many billions of dollars to pour into renewable energy generation.
But look a little closer, and the numbers tell a more complicated story. While construction on big batteries and solar farms in Australia's biggest electricity system is steaming ahead, wind farms and transmission lines are struggling to get off the ground.
I'm not going to gild the lily. It's difficult to build things at the moment in Australia as wind is hard.
It's a problem reflected in the Australian Energy Market Operators, or AEMO's, latest integrated system plan, which serves as a blueprint for Australia's goal of getting 82% of its power from renewable sources by 2030. In an updated draft version, the market operator has slashed its forecast for the amount of wind capacity that will be built by that time. David Dixon is an analyst at Rystad Energy.
The previous ISP in 2024 stated that we need to roughly bring online about 5 gigawatts a year of wind to 2030. We've not even ever hit half the magnitude needed, and we've had no wind farms start construction in 2025.
He says the shortfalls are only making Australia's renewable energy goals harder to achieve.
Naturally, as you miss a year of 5 gigawatts, you have to make it up even more in the following year. And as you can see, you're kind of chasing your tail and the goal becomes even more and more challenging to meet.
Amid soaring costs and entrenched opposition in some places, AEMO has also scaled back its calls for new high-voltage power lines. Whereas the agency previously said 10,000 kilometres of new lines were needed to reach net zero by 2050, it now says the figure is closer to 6,000 kilometres. It forecasts much of the difference will be made up by large-scale solar farms backed up by big batteries and households installing ever more solar panels and storage of their own. Chris O'Keefe from the Clean Energy Council says perspective is needed.
In 2015, less than 15% of Australia's electricity was generated by renewables 10 years ago. Now it's close to 50. We're doing pretty well as a country, and the settings are in place for Australia to be really successful here.
That's Chris O'Keefe from the Clean Energy Council ending Daniel Mercer's report. And in a statement, the Federal Minister for Climate Change and Energy, Chris Bowen, says the report confirms households are leading the energy transition and renewable energy backed by gas and storage is the only plan backed by experts. It's estimated financial and economic abuse costs the Australian economy nearly $11 billion a year and affects more than 2.4 million people. A new study of coerced business debt, where someone's forced to take on their romantic partner's debt, has revealed its impact on domestic abuse survivors. Nassim Kadem reports.
Louise, which isn't her real name, was given just 21 days to pay about $20,000 of tax debt. She says her ex-husband signed her up as a company director without telling her. Louise's voice is being played by an actor.
The ATO said I took the money out, and I said to them I did not do that. I didn't even have access to the bank account.
Louise says her ex also withdrew $250,000 from their joint self-managed super fund, which she's been unable to recover.
I didn't realise that everything that I've endured is actually financial abuse until after I separated.
Economic abuse is estimated to cost the economy almost $11 billion a year and impacts more than 2.4 million Australians. The federal government's consulting on major reforms, including making it harder for company directors to be appointed without clear consent. Assistant Minister for Treasury Andrew Lee says legislation could be in place next year.
Our goal is to find ways of addressing the important issue of domestic and family violence while still ensuring that we don't increase the regulatory burden on Australian firms in a disproportionate way.
Jasmine Opdam works with victims at Redfern Legal Centre's Financial Abuse Service. She's helped lead the first Australia-wide study into coerced business debt and its devastating impact.
These coerced business debts rob women of their financial autonomy and often take years and years to recover from, if at all.
Jasmine Opdam worries the government's current proposals don't go far enough because they only focus on company directorships.
We see perpetrators fraudulently setting up ABNs so that their partners are operating as sole traders but being controlled by the perpetrator. We see perpetrators fraudulently lodging tax returns and using GST fraud schemes that they take the benefit from. And we see perpetrators using self-managed superannuation funds.
Ann K.S. Kumar is the founding director of UNSW's Tax and Business Advisory Clinic. It regularly sees people face what she calls sexually transmitted tax debts, where an abuser passes on the debt over to their partner. She wants the law to be changed to allow the ATO to relieve victims of their debts.
And instead, the perpetrator, because they are the one responsible for creating the tax debt, would be held financially liable for paying that off.
The ATO can't comment on individual taxpayers. It told ABC News it can't waive tax debts entirely, but can be more supportive of victims facing abuse and recently introduced a new vulnerability framework to improve the way it handles such cases.
Asim Kadem there, and if you're in an abusive situation or you know someone who is, you can call 1-800-RESPECT. It's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, call 000. A rare dinosaur fossil known as Spike is about to be auctioned in London, and enthusiasts are going to need deep pockets if they want it. Some say it could sell for more than $10 million. Cyan Valance reports.
Millions of years after it roamed the Earth, Spike, the dinosaur skeleton, is expected to sell at auction for millions of dollars. Part of the Caenognathid family, Spike is made up of around 100 fossil bones, an incredibly rare find. The head of science and natural history at Christie's Auction House, James Hislop, says Spike could even be a new species.
I certainly won't get another chance to sell something like this in my lifetime. We've had interest from international collectors.
Spike's price guide is between $6 and $10 million, but insiders say he could go for more. The dinosaur market is red hot. In 2020, a T-Rex nicknamed Stan was expected to sell for $8 million.
At 5'5".
$6 million,
thank you very much.
In the end, he went for $47 million. That was a record until last year, when a stegosaurus known as Apex beat Stan's price...
Sold!
...by around $20 million. Mr. Hislop says demand is enormous.
It's not that surprising. We all grew up as kids fascinated by dinosaurs, and that sense of childlike wonder still pervades into adulthood.
Some buyers remain anonymous. Others are very well known, like Aussie actor Russell Crowe, who recently told radio host Howard Stern about his own dabble in the dinosaur market.
They've just about almost doubled in value since I sold it, actually.
But the booming business has become a bone of contention. Professor Susanna Maidment is a paleontologist at London's Natural History Museum.
The problem with fossil auctions, and particularly with dinosaur fossils, is that the prices that they tend to reach are way, way, way beyond on the acquisition budgets of, you know, the vast majority of museums and certainly beyond us. So I think it's extremely unlikely that we would even get a look in.
Some of the museum's fossils have been studied and restudied for 150 years as new technology unlocks more prehistoric secrets. Professor Maidment.
If they then go into private collections, we as paleontologists don't work on them. So they're effectively lost to science.
Mr. Hislop says some wealthy buyers do lend or donate the fossils.
They like the idea of people being able to access the specimens and study them. And certainly we've made Spike available to the scientific community while he's been in our temporary custodianship.
Spike will go under the hammer and possibly over the estimate on Thursday. This is Cyan Valence in London, reporting for AM.
And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sydney Peed from the ABC News Daily podcast. In the first week of summer, dozens of houses have been destroyed in bushfires. Today, the ABC's Central Coast reporter, Sarah Forster, on the homes that were lost and the ones still standing after Saturday's fire, and an expert on building fire-safe houses in high-risk areas, on which homes are prepared for the fire season ahead. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.